The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
This is Minnesota Native News Community Health Conversations with hosts Leah Lim and Dr. Anthony Stately. Community Health Conversations is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health.
Anin, hello, I'm Leah Lim.
And I'm Anthony Stately. We're back with more conversations, more explorations about how healthcare in Indian Country is responding and adapting beyond the COVID-19 pandemic. Miigwech, and thank you for joining us.
Buju, Dr. Anthony Stately. It's nice to see you again.
You as well, Leah. How are you today?
I am actually doing all right. And you?
I'm doing well. I'm enjoying the warmer weather, finally. But I guess winter was kind of warm too, but like this is a different kind of warm because it comes with sunshine.
The sunshine, it means so much. We just have to keep those wildfires at bay.
God, I was really upset that I couldn't see the Aurora Borealis down here this far too. It's like I'm watching everybody post about the amazing things they're seeing and I'm seeing smoke.
I just slept through it. I didn't even try. I said, Nate, I gotta sleep.
Yeah, it sounds like I should have done the same thing, probably.
But I'm really excited for today's conversation. We are going to be speaking with Chef Sean Sherman. Sean has dedicated his career to supporting and promoting Indigenous food systems and Native food sovereignty through his activism and advocacy. Sean is helping to reclaim and celebrate the rich culinary heritage of Indigenous communities around the world. But first, let's talk about where we are in health.
As of late April, COVID-19 case rates for the American Indian population has the lowest numbers of all the ethnic groups tracked by the Minnesota Department of Health. That is no small victory, so yay. This time last year, our numbers were the highest at more than double the rate of the infections compared to all other groups.
And hospitalization rates for the American Indian population is slowly on the rise again. As we head into the warmer months, it's imperative that we take preventative measures individually and collectively to keep these numbers low.
Those who have COVID-19 may be able to spread the disease to other people before they have symptoms. Research has shown that around half of all people who get COVID-19 do not have symptoms. If you think there's a chance that you're sick and you might be asymptomatic, it's important that you still test to make sure that you're not passing the virus to people that you love around you.
Mm-hmm. And prevention strategies are also a way to keep yourself and your loved ones safe. Improved hygiene methods like washing your hands thoroughly with soap and hot water, covering your cough, as well as opening a window for airflow, or even holding gatherings outside to help decrease the amount of virus in the air are all great strategies.
When it comes to COVID-19 testing, be sure to check the expiration dates on your at-home tests and throw them away if they are expired. If you have health insurance, you may be able to get free tests or get reimbursed for those costs by reaching out to your insurance company for more detailed information. If you are uninsured, you can find no-cost testing locations near you by visiting testinglocator.cdc.gov.
As we continue to face unprecedented air quality alerts, those who are in sensitive groups or have increased exposure to the outdoors should take precautions and stay informed to lessen the impact these factors have on their health. What do you think, Dr. Stately?
That's absolutely important. And we're seeing the impact of those things most recently with some of the wildfires that have caused air quality alerts. And we know that things like carcinogens and the toxins and those kinds of things can really have damage on your lungs and also trigger other cardiovascular related disorders. So if you suffer from those things already, or you have other chip related challenges, you should really be very cautious about going outdoors and also be very cautious about your activities.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News Community Health Conversations. This program is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health. Find information about COVID vaccines and boosters online at mn.gov/COVID-19. We're happy to have joining us today the incomparable Sean Sherman. In 2023, Time magazine named Sean as one of the top 100 most influential people, conquering prestigious accolades such as the James Beard Award to the Julia Child Award. Sean's most important and influential work lies at the intersection of Indigenous food sovereignty and unraveling the throes of colonization, one ingredient at a time. Do you want to take a moment and introduce yourself?
My name is Sean Sherman. I am from Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota. I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota. And I am currently here in Minneapolis, where I have created Awamani, the restaurant downtown Minneapolis, along with my brand, The Sous Chef, along with our nonprofit Natives, which is a long name of North American traditional indigenous food systems. And we have our indigenous food lab set up under that brand at the Midtown Global Market.
Excellent. And this is Community Health Conversation. So what we really try to drill down into is community culture and how that plays a role in the health of our communities. So why don't we just hit the ground running here with Indigenous food traditions and how they contribute to the overall health and well-being of Native communities. Sean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, food for me is something that's a really important part of my life, and it has been for a long time because I've been in restaurants forever. And, you know, for me in my journey of really at one point in my chef career, realizing the absence of Native foods out there and realizing the absence of that education in myself and not even really understanding what my Lakota ancestors were eating, not even that long ago, you know, is, I looked at like, when was the last line of my Lakota ancestors to hold 100% of the knowledge around food? And it was just, less than 100 years before my birth, because they don't discover gold in the Black Hills till 1876. And I was born in 1974. And so, things moved fast. So for me, it was trying to understand what we lost. And I think it's really important as we gain more understanding of what our true indigenous foods are and can be moving forward, that there's a lot of health involved with what our foods are, you know. So I think Awamani is a good representation of something that can happen with modern indigenous foods. You know, so the philosophy that I created of like showcasing kind of decolonized foods was cutting out colonial ingredients, removing things like dairy, flour, wheat, sugar, beef, pork, chicken, and really focusing on a lot of indigenous food production, a lot of wild food, and returning a lot of that knowledge, a lot of agricultural pieces. And the food base becomes so healthy for us if we're able to eat in that manner. And now it's just a matter of how can we make that accessible, you know? So there's a lot of problems to overcome because we've been living in a colonized state for so long. We've been really forced to deal with the recommendations of the USDA and the government as to what our health should be. And I think that we really need to start to regain control of our own health when it comes to foodways and really put a lot of our efforts into raising a deeper understanding of our indigenous foods on top of just making more production of indigenous foods possible and just like literally getting into the mouths of our indigenous community as much as we can.
I love that, into the mouths instead of into their minds. But in a lot of ways, with the work you've done both, right? So you got into their mouths, you got into their bellies, and you also got into their minds. Can you talk about some of the challenges that you faced in reclaiming and preserving traditional indigenous ingredients, recipes, and culinary techniques, and how you overcame those things?
So for me, it was just like, where do I start from the beginning? Like, who do I ask? You know, I always teased I couldn't just go online and order Joy of Native American Cooking because it just didn't exist, you know? And so I had to really like think about like putting myself in the shoes of my ancestors. Like, what were my ancestors eating? What were they, how were they preserving foods? What did we use for salts and fats and sugars? What was our knowledge of plants? How did we know what to do with all the parts of the animals that we utilized, and started to piece together some of the pieces, you know, and asking myself, what would an indigenous pantry be today? You know, so like modernizing it too. Because it's one thing to try to recreate the past, but I think what's more important is to think about how we move forward. Like, how do we step forward? How can we normalize making indigenous foods a part of our daily lives? And how can we bring that access out there? So I think understanding ingredients was one step of it, identifying those pantries, creating new recipes, you know, because there's still a lot of traditional recipes out there, but that doesn't mean we can't evolve. That doesn't mean we can't grow and move into creating lots of new recipes. Because at Awamni, we've been open for 2.5 years and we've created hundreds of recipes over that time period. And there's so much room for opportunity for creativity when it comes to Indigenous foods that I just think that culinary is a really important tool to be able to really focus on, you know, into allowing some of these creative kitchens to come up with all sorts of ways to play with our really beautiful food bases, whether they're wild foods, agricultural products, game, proteins, birds, whatever, even insects, you know, like there's just a lot of options out there. So for me, I feel like it's a really exciting time because I'm seeing more and more Native chefs and Native food businesses starting to roll out. And it's a really difficult business, which is part of why with our nonprofit, we're just trying to be a support center to help other people to make it easier for them to do this work. Because I had to grind a lot to get to where I'm at. And I had to play a long game to get here. And I want to make it easier for people to be able to move this forward because we should have access to our Indigenous foods in every single tribal community out there, you know, and we should have education around that too. So there's a lot of work to do again, was really what it comes down to.
Great. And we know that, you know, the types of foods are different because, you know, going to Awamni and having crickets as the croutons instead of little chunks of bread, fantastic. But how do you see the actual makeup and the nutritional value compare to a Western diet? I'd imagine there's more protein or something like that that is different than what might be the standard American diet. And how do you think that change impacts community health or that difference?
I would say just, you know, what we've done with the philosophy that was created, that if you go to Awamni, the entire menu is gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free, soy-free, pork-free, and more, you know. And but it doesn't mean it's like that's limiting, because I feel like we have a lot more plant diversity on our in our menu than most restaurants. I feel like the Western diet has historically ignored almost this wonderful plant life around us in the United States where we live today and Turtle Island in general, you know. And I think that there's a lot of understanding that we can pull from our Indigenous ancestors to see the world differently and to see that there's a lot more plants out there that we could be utilizing in our diets every single day. And being able to understand how to preserve things, how to dry things, and how to make things last in the seasons, because some of our wild foods are only out for a few weeks and then they're gone for the whole year, you know. So our Indigenous ancestors, you know, put a lot of effort and time and respect into harvesting things to make sure that they had access to those foods and that they could utilize them throughout the year. And it's just a really extremely healthy base, you know. And I feel like a lot of the Western diet has been struggling to try to understand and catch up with itself of like coming up with all sorts of diet fads and trying all this. But the problem is it uses so much processed food, you know, and like at Awamni, over half the menu can be plant-based, because if we don't have meat or protein on it, then it's, you know, completely plants. There's because there's no butter and dairy and cheese on everything, you know, no ranch dressing and all those kinds of things, you know. So it's really easy for it to be just healthy. And I think being modern day chefs and being modern day restaurateurs, that we should feel responsible to what we're feeding our customers. And not only that, but who are we purchasing from? Because if I was just calling this a Native restaurant, but then buying all my ingredients from like a large box truck organization, you know, or everything's coming from Walmart or something like that, that doesn't help, you know? So we have to really focus on helping to grow this economy, to open up this opportunity for to create more demand around these foods. And I think it'll all help out in the end, because we're just, again, like the goal is to help to normalize modern Indigenous foods moving forward. And I've said at a few of the dinners that I've had recently is like, I want to see that happen. Like I want to like this next generation of kids to be able to go out at night and think like, oh, what do I want for dinner tonight? Do I want pizza? Do I want Chinese? Do I want Native American? And I want that to be on the list out there for them to choose. Like we should at least have that, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And just a quick follow-up to that. What does the diet look like at the height of winter?
So in the winter months, of course, because we're obviously in a winter state, you know, because we have a good 5 months of really nice growing weather season. We're in the beginning of it right now here. And then we have like, what, 27 months of winter or something like that in Minnesota. It's long, right? And then So we have to think about like how people, how did we survive in winter before all these things? You know, we lived in a refrigerator basically. So food preservation, there's many different methods to it, but obviously it's just a matter of like, if we are able to really understand the plant world around us, you know, and like, I love growing food even at my house. I have a big garden in my front yard and I have lots of wild plants around my yard that I can just pull from throughout the year. But at the harvest season, like, take the time to preserve and do everything, like dry things, pickle things, jar things, whatever method you want, you know. Freezing can only last so long. Like, I prefer some of the other methods, but you can freeze stuff, of course. But I think it's really important to think about like those kinds of pieces, you know, because it helps us define winter. It's cold. We want to be inside. I like long, slow cooked meals that take all day and make your house smell really good. And, you know, there's a lot of things we can do. So if you look at the menus at Waumne during the wintertime, you can see it reflects a lot of those kinds of hearty meals where it's warming and all those kinds of things, you know, but it's still healthy.
That's awesome. I like the idea of being at your house with cooking that took all day long and your house is just filled with all those smells. So I'll wait for my invitation at some point.
Okay. I have a fireplace and I even set up my fireplace so I can just cook a pot right over the fire.
I forget what dish it was. I went to your restaurant one time and it was so amazing. I was at dinner with my mom and a few other people. And I was like, okay, I want to be buried in this. And just pointed at the dish. I'm like, make sure that you bury me with this. It was so good. I wanted it to be habit forever. The passion behind your work often seems to intersect with issues that are related to cultural preservation, language preservation. Your dishes even are named Indigenous names. How do you see Indigenous foodways as a tool for reclaiming our cultural identity and resisting the effects of colonialism?
I think there's so much opportunity for education around Indigenous foods because our Western education system has pretty much removed that. Like, it doesn't exist out there, you know. We don't learn about the plants. We don't learn about the trees. We barely learn about the animals, you know. And I do a lot of speaking engagements, and I would always tease in my talks that our kids can name more of the Kardashians than they can tree species, you know. And, like, we just really need to think about what our education opportunities are out there. And we should really be teaching about food and health because food is something we need every day. So why isn't that a part of our education, you know? And we should be talking about our culturally relevant foods, of things that have deep meanings to not only our families, but the ancestors behind us, you know, because we just, you know, if our ancestors could, they would give us all of that knowledge because that's how it was built. It was built to pass down generation upon generation, you know? And because our Western education system stopped that from happening, we have the opportunity to start that again. Like, we can just take it upon ourselves to start to teach about our Indigenous foodways. And there's so much there's so much to think about because it's plant identification, it's medicines, it's food and culinary and food preservation and cooking techniques and creating seasonings and spices and utilizing natural sugars and breaking down whole animals. Like, there's so much to think about when it comes to the education around our foodways. And it's a great place to start because food was the one thing that we all need. It's the one thing we all have in common as humans across the world. And our Indigenous ancestors, that was one of the center points, you know, because we had to process food all throughout the whole year to make sure that we had enough food to stay alive for a whole community. And everybody chipped in. The entire community worked hard on that, you know, and it was a community-based food system. And we should have more community values in our food systems instead of really focusing on the individualism, because that's all a part of the capitalist. Like we're taught that if we want food, we have to have money to get it. Where instead, like, if we're a community, we can all work together to create the food that we need if we really wanted to go in that direction, because that's how our ancestors survived countless generations before us, you know, before there was all of these, all this capitalistic system that's around us today.
And then one other thing I wanted to touch on about the environmental sustainability bit is, I don't know exactly what the measurement would be, but like nutrition per acre or something like that. Like, when you grow food, when you, you know, have livestock or, you know, forage and things like that, there must be some sort of difference in nutrition per square acre.
Because if you're thinking about like how our ancestors treated food systems and how we were growing foods, producing foods, whether we were in agricultural zone or not, like we had so much food around us, you know. So even in agricultural zones, we're growing diverse forms. You know, there's a lot of seeds being grown. It's not like one monocrop kind of situation that just covers acres and acres, you know, but it's like all these different seeds, and in each family kind of has their own garden plots growing all different seeds from each other too, you know. And then plus you're just utilizing the world around us, because we had that knowledge to see nothing but food and medicine by looking out our window, you know, and seeing all the plants have a purpose for us, you know, and we have that deep relationship with them. And I just think that there's so much there for us to understand when it comes down to it. Because if we look at the way, you know, a lot of these big GMO companies that they're just growing, they're pushing for all this gigantic monocrop situation, it's not helping anything, because they're forcing chemicals onto all this food that's getting into the waterways, that's getting into our bodies. And it's in the middle of all the foods in the middle of our grocery store. Like, we can't get away from some of those really dangerous chemicals. And we're basically just being treated like lab rats to see what's going to happen to us when we microdose glyphosate for the next 30 years or whatever, you know? And so we have to really kind of think about, like, again, as indigenous producers, we're not going to be doing that. Like, we can be focused on different ways, and we can start to indigenize a lot of our food growing processes. And we don't have to try to do everything like the past. We can just create the future moving forward. I think that's what it's all about. It's like, it's not about returning to the past, you know. And for me, decolonization doesn't mean returning to the past or pretending colonization doesn't happen. It's just comparing the values of colonization, of what colonization has normalized in our lives, which is a focus on individuality. It's a focus on the power of money. It's the focus on dehumanizing people of color. It's the focus of control, all these things that colonization has, and, you know, land theft and just the monetizing land in general. And you compare that to indigenous values, where we're focused on our community. We're focused on our traditions. We're focused on our language. We're focused on creating a relationship with the world around us and utilizing it in a healthier way.
I have a question, and I'm going to start by saying, you know, when you first opened up your restaurant, I remember people being really excited about it. I also heard people like say, like, well, you know, where's the fry bread, you know, that kind of stuff, right? Because we equate fry bread with indigeneity sometimes, like, because it's so prevalent, but it's clearly a colonized food, right? But there's probably a lot of people out there in the community and all across Turtle Island or that are a lot like me, who, you know, have a hard time, like, you know, keeping the basil plant alive that they buy from, you know, the the local store. You don't even like use fresh basil. How can individuals and communities across Turtle Island support the promotion of indigenous food sovereignty, you know, be engaged in like growing or harvesting or foraging for their own food, improving the health outcomes of Native people in Minnesota and beyond? Like, Where would you tell people to start, or how can they be engaged?
You know, I think the education is a big part of it. And that's why with our nonprofit at Natives, our two main pillars is just creating the food access for indigenous foods, but also creating the education access, because we know I can't just give somebody a 2-pound bag of dried corn and expect them to know exactly what to do with it, you know? So the education has to be there. And I think that we really need to support a lot of education around our foodways, whether it's understanding wild foods and wild plants or seed saving and farming techniques and some of the ancestry around that, processing, you know, creating salts, creating fats, creating sugars, whatever it might be. Like, there's a lot to focus on. So I think we really need to really lean into the education side of things deeply. To normalize it, it should just be part of our school systems. You know, there should be normalized having indigenous foods all the time, not just around Thanksgiving. You know, we need to like see it happen a lot, you know. And if you're at Awamni and if you walk around outside, you can see that we used only indigenous plants around the whole restaurant. And there's little placards there that show the native name first. It'll have the Dakota name of that plant and then an English description of how that plant can be used. And a lot of those flavors end up in our restaurant because we're using a lot of wild plants around us, you know. We're not harvesting from the park because that would be gross, but we are utilizing a lot of these amazing products coming from Minnesota and ideally from indigenous producers, you know. But I feel like that's an easy one schools could do. Like, why don't just like you know, walk around the school and like name all the plants and give them the original names of wherever they might be, whether in Anishinaabe or Dakota or Ho-Chunk or wherever it might live, you know, and just have that opportunity for people to connect with outdoors more. So you don't grow up calling every plant a weed because you never had the education to learn it, you know? So I think that's a big part of our challenge is that education as normalizing Indigenous education, you know, and we have to create some of it, you know, because some of it was lost, but we have the opportunity to redevelop it moving forward by putting our Indigenous values first into our education, thinking about the health of our next generations and what we want them to see as normal in the future.
Great. Well, as we wrap up here, I just want to ask, what's on your mind as far as your next steps, whether it's anything you're hoping to do in the next couple of years or anything you're planning on doing in the next couple of years around your work?
Well, I'm going to be a race car driver when I grow up.
Heck first. Yeah.
you know, I'm just looking forward. I feel like, you know, we've proven what's possible with Awamini in a really good manner. You know, we're able to win things like best new restaurant in the entire nation from the James Beard Foundation, mm-hmm. which is massive award, but also just doing something different, you know, creating a restaurant without ranch dressing and having it be successful. And being able to like showcase that health, that putting health first can work, that we don't have to have a 6,000 calorie hamburger on the menu just to stay alive, that we can put a whole bunch of interesting things that really push health and culture in front of everything else, you know? And so I'm just looking forward to actually growing this outwards because we're just getting ready to start replicating this whole model with what we have at the food lab is the market space where we have about 50 Indigenous food producers in there right now. We have the classroom where we're starting to do lots of videos around showcasing people what to do with a lot of these foods and any other education topic we want to teach about, creating a kitchen that is really focused on creating a lot of Indigenous food products that we can sell through the restaurant and through the market and to individuals. And then the restaurant itself, which creates the jobs, moves a lot of this product in mass and becomes a really strong voice and a place for people to come and learn. And so we're replicating all of this right now in Bozeman, and we're just getting all ready to put it all together. So we'll have all those components, including a restaurant at some point. But we've also planting seeds in places like Anchorage, Honolulu, Rapid City, Oklahoma, California, and beyond. Like we just want to help normalize and create center points of support for more Indigenous culinary operations out there everywhere. And we have a very clear vision. So it's a lot of work to do, but that's what I'm most excited about is just seeing this work unfold. So I know that this work will surpass my lifetime and that these future generations of Indigenous community and these young children will have a chance of having access to these foods, having education around these foods and having a better access to health in general. So we're not going to be slowly killing ourselves with processed foods.
So after you get done doing this here on Turtle Island, I think you should go over to Scotland and decolonize their food. Because when I was there okay. for a week, I mean, it's interesting. It's different, that's for sure. But man, I was like, oh God, I could not live here.
But we do want to cross colonial borders and be overseas because we are working with people like in Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, of course, Southeast Asia, Africa, India, South America. And there's so much opportunity out there on a global scale to connect us as Indigenous peoples everywhere.
That's awesome. Congratulations on all your awards and all your hard work.
Absolutely. Thank you.
What a great conversation. Sean Sherman is a brilliant mind. I really appreciate having him on the program. So chimigweit, Sean Sherman, and thank you again for joining us today. It was a great time.
Yeah, that was a really wonderful conversation. Thank you all for listening today. Chimigweit. I'm Ashton Stately.
And I'm Leah Lem, Gigawabaman, and we wish you health.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News, Community Health Conversations. This program is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health. Find information about COVID vaccines and boosters online at mn.gov/COVID-19. Minnesota Native News, Community Health Conversations is supported by the Minnesota Department of Health. Find information about COVID vaccines and boosters online at mn.gov/COVID-19. Find more of our conversations at minnesotanativenews.org/community-conversations.
Programming on KFAI is sustained by underwriters like the Walker Art Center and the Bell Museum. Thank you so much for your support. Learn more about becoming a KFAI underwriter at kfai.org/underwriting.
KFAI is proud to present Arc Welder at the Turf Club on Saturday, June 8th. Minneapolis-based Arc Welder is celebrating nearly 40 years of playing together by releasing a new album, Continue. Opening the show is local group Products Band. Tickets for Arc Welder can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
Programming is supported by the Minnesota Historical Society, presenting Black Citizenship in the Age of Jim Crow. Following the journey of Black advancement from the end of the Civil War through World War I in the face of opposition from many white Americans. This exhibit highlights Black resilience and resistance through art, artifacts, and photographs. On view at the Minnesota History Center on June 9th. Tickets and more information at mnhs.info/history.